They'd been no advantage against him before. There was only one more thing. She dipped her hand into her pocket and felt the smooth, cool sphere she always kept there. Immediately, the spell shattered to pieces. Tendrils of black, burning filaments fell to the ground, scorching and burrowing into the soil. No more burning hot coals, no more boiling flesh. When she looked at her skin, it was smooth and untouched. But Shaudel still held the sword. "Use what is available to you," the king had told her following their game of intrigue. She drew the moonstone out. It was all she had. At first, the stone did nothing, and all Kerrigan could do was back away from Shaudel's intent advance. Then, the stone flared to life in a single silver blade of light. Shaudel stopped his advance in surprise. It was like a sword in her hand. She shifted it this way and that, and it swept through the air as a well-made blade should. Now she advanced, and Shaudel met her. Their swords did not clang when they touched as two metal blades would. Rather, they hummed as if resonating against one another, light and dark. Silver sparks cascaded about them, and a thread of smoke curled up from Shaudel's sword. The light of the moonstone grew within and without her, drawing on her strength and memory, gathering together everything she had ever learned about survival, and putting that knowledge in her immediate grasp. It was as if all her experiences during her long journey had finally come full circle in a combination that guided her hands and feet with a confidence and competence she had not known before. When their swords crossed and they pushed on one another, Shaudel hissed, "Aletheia has truly failed if it relies on a weak mortal to fight its battles." Kerrigan pushed him away with a grunt and battered him with another volley of blows. "Elysian moonlight is nothing over the power of Mournhaven the Black," Shaudel shouted. In a calm, quiet voice, Kerrigan answered, "Aletheia has nothing to do with it." The ghosts stood as supernatural witnesses in a fluctuating gray ring about the two combatants. Shaudel cut low at Kerrigan's knees. She whipped the moonbeam blade in a luminous arc and blocked it. She thrust at his chest, but he sidled away and swung back with a slash to her stomach. It went back and forth like this oddly silent sword fight. Kerrigan used many techniques she learned from Arms Master Rendell and Freyan Kobelbay. The ghost had shown her more than anyone when he had claimed her body during her fight with Torn. She had felt how to move her body in a precise way when wielding a sword. She had learned how to anticipate and meet the enemy. Rendell and Freyan had taught her well, and she owed her survival in this duel thus far to them. One element was missing, however, that would help her overcome Shaudel. It was what the cargo master Savano had taught her. Unpredictability. As they traded blows, Kerrigan awaited the appropriate moment. It came in the form of an especially hard blow delivered by Shaudel. Kerrigan stumbled back and fell to her knees as if stunned. She looked up at Shaudel with beseeching eyes, holding her breath, the sword tip to the ground in the position of surrender. Shaudel laughed in triumph and brought his own sword down like an axe intended to split her in half. Kerrigan loosed a blood-curdling scream of suppressed rage, closed in on him, and wrapped her arms about his waist. The sword swung far too wide to touch her. She knocked him over and rolled away. Quick as a cat, Shaudel was on his feet again. The ploy had failed, and now he would expect anything from her. Where Kerrigan's instincts of survival and her experiences once helped her, they now faded away, leaving her drained and feeling hopeless. She could not go on much longer. She saw in Shaudel's sparkling eyes that he knew. The light of Lorelin had been made ages ago to face the dark, to repel and defeat it. 1,000 years ago, Elysian warriors of the League had carried blades of light to turn the tide of the dark. The light would not tolerate the dark then, nor would it now. The blade of light intensified rather than diminished at Kerrigan's despair. Hope flared within her, as if she were part of the light. The whole ridge ignited in brilliance, more brilliant than sunlight. And the ghosts, shadows of the afterlife, blanched. Chaudel's triumphant look turned to one of uncertainty, and Kerrigan sprang forward. With all her power and might, she chopped down on Chaudel's blade. There was an explosion of light that went beyond the brilliance of a silver moonbeam. It was a crystallized, pure whiteness that blinded the eye. Then she thrust at him and cut deep. Chaudel floundered back. He held a shattered sword in one hand and held his stomach to keep his guts from spilling out with the other. He opened his mouth to speak, but only blood poured out. Kerrigan panted.
You underestimate the will of mortals to survive. You've underestimated all along.
But even as she watched, the folds of flesh around his gashed belly began to knit together beneath his hand. Though blood still spilled from his lips, he said,
And you underestimate the dark powers, girl. Your moonbeam is nothing.
As if in angry response, the moonbeam sword coalesced upon itself into a bright, shining sphere. The light grew and flared with multiple rays of light, seeking, searching. Chaudel dropped his useless sword hilt to shield his eyes and staggered backward. As on the silver moon night, when she had seen him walking after the ball, he seemed protected by a black shield. But this time, the shield fluctuated, thinning here and thickening there. The more his shield faltered, the more the moonbeams grew and probed for a weakness, and stabbed. Chaudel screamed, and his gray tunic darkened with blood. He backed away, still holding his half-healed belly, and flailing his other arm madly, as if he were being attacked by a hive of bees. His gray horse appeared from the woods, and he staggered after it, fighting the moonbeam all the way. He crawled onto the horse's back like a wounded spider, and urged it into a gallop. The blade of light streaked after him into the woods. Chaudel's slave spirits howled plaintively and disappeared. The green rider ghosts merged and faded. Somewhere in the valley, a green rider captain watched incredulously as her assailant dropped her sword in mid-strike. Kerrigan closed her eyes for a moment. When she opened them, she looked at her palm. The moonstone was no more than a handful of crystalline fragments glittering in the sun. The moonbeam was gone forever. She slipped the fragments into her velvet pouch. Kerrigan sagged to the ground next to Alton Dyer. She brushed his hair away from his wan face. He breathed shallowly, still alive despite the arrow in his side. She didn't know how to help him, but held his hand and spoke quiet, encouraging words, not knowing if he even heard her. In time, Captain Mapstone limped up the ridge toward her, leading her horse behind her. Her green uniform was splayed with blood, that of her enemies, Kerrigan concluded, though there was an ugly gash above her brow, and blood stained her face like a mask. The captain gazed wearily at her, at the two messenger horses, and at Alton Dyer sprawled on the ground. She dropped the reins of her horse and knelt beside Alton.
He still lives, she said in surprise. She yanked the arrow from his side and quickly wadded the wound with cloth. The wound itself is nothing, but who knows what evil this arrow is tainted with. He is in fever now.
Give it to me.
What?
Captain Mapstone gazed at Kerrigan's outstretched hand, not comprehending.
The arrow, Kerrigan said. Give it to me.
The captain looked at it doubtfully for a moment, but complied when she observed Kerrigan's determined expression. Kerrigan touched the arrow reluctantly. She could feel the taint of death in it, the torture. Before that taint could seep through her skin, she broke the arrow on her knee.
What?
Captain Mapstone raised a brow, but when Alton coughed and groaned, she returned her attention to him.
Kerrigan walked down into the valley among the carnage, across the blood-slit grasses. The dead lay in mockery to the beautiful lupin that wavered in a breeze. The Saccharidian dead had been separated from the ground mites. She detached herself from the gore and searched for those impaled by black arrows. When she found the arrows, she broke them. When she dropped the remnants of the last arrow to the ground, she found herself by King Zachary. He knelt amidst the Saccharidian dead, his people, and sobbed into his hand. The other hung at an awkward angle at his side, as if his arm had been broken. Nearby, six white corpses lay in a row, including the smiling terrier, Finder. She looked away, not wishing to intrude on his grief, and walked to where Condor stood at the edge of the battlefield, his head hanging low. Kerrigan stumbled over a ground mite shield emblazoned with a dead black tree. What it could portend, she did not know, and was too tired to think about it. The next move. Kerrigan jerked awake with a cry. The sun had moved its way over the west ridge, angling deep shadows across the waving grasses and lupin of the Valley of the Lost Lake, which had once been the mirror of the moon in Duraluin. Raven circled in the sky, waiting to alight on the battlefield, waiting to see what scraps of gore they could feed on. The encroaching shadows chilled Kerrigan, and she shivered. "You all right?" Captain Mapstone sat next to her, huddled beneath her short coat, which was draped over her shoulders. Kerrigan sat up and nodded. She had been overcome by a great weariness not long after Horse Marshal Martell's 50 light horse had trotted into the valley, all shining helms and breastplates, the horses held in perfect formation. Their display of decorum would have impressed any parade spectator. However, when the soldiers saw the black smoke pluming from the pyre, flames licking the corpses of ground mites, and when they saw the wounded, their decorum faltered. Eyes popped open, oaths were sworn. Some made the sign of the half moon, and others simply stopped in their tracks. Feeble from blood loss and hard-pressed to even stand, Captain Mapstone had limped up to the horse marshal and shouted, "Get off those horses and help us!" She must have sounded half-crazed to them, but she had sounded just the way Kerrigan felt. She wanted to shout and scream, too. The cavalry soldiers practically fell over one another to make themselves useful. A mender among them set the king's broken arm and attended the wounded. The soldiers began the grisly task of caring for the dead. Common soldiers and nobles alike were laid out side by side.
"They were all warriors of Saccharidia today," the king said. "As such, they were all equals and heroes all."
Kerrigan had set to work to help the soldiers build a cairn over the dead, but as she bent to pick up a rock, she was assailed by dizziness and her knees buckled. That was when she must have taken the nap.
"No, I passed out, didn't I?"
Captain Mapstone nodded. "Whatever it was you did on the ridge today to that Elysian, it must have sapped your strength." Kerrigan rubbed her temples to stave off a ferocious headache. Some ending to a perfectly good picnic. The captain tugged her short coat more snugly about her.
"The king lives. I would not say that was a bad ending."
Some distance away, King Zachary spoke with the horse marshal. His broken arm was splinted and bound securely to his chest, but he was quite alive.
"If you hadn't come when you did," Kerrigan began, "the king would be dead?"
The captain cocked her head as if considering.
"Perhaps, perhaps not.
One cannot predict other outcomes so easily."
"You cracked the code in Freyan Kobolbe's letter?"
"Yes." Captain Mapstone went on to explain how she and two other riders had worked for many hours to find the hidden message. It told of an Elysian who could not be trusted, and that the king's brother would take the throne by force. The attempt on the king was to coincide with his annual hunt. When we learned Shardell was missing after the king had left with his party, we became concerned. More than concerned, in fact. A rider reported seeing a band of ground mites in this area.
Captain Mapstone gazed sadly at the few riders left alive.
Two tended three wounded, including Alton Dyer. The rest were disappearing beneath the stone cairn being raised by the cavalry soldiers. She cradled a dented silver horn in her lap.
I wish we could have come sooner.
Kerrigan winced. If I'd given you the letter sooner. The captain reached over and patted her on the knee. I don't think any of us would have suspected the letter was more than it seemed. An expression of love from Freean Coblebay to one he cared about tremendously. Much in that letter was genuine. Perhaps Freean knew Lady Astora would find it strange and bring it to one of us. It seems he knew he wouldn't make it back to Sacra City himself.
Why was it in code? Kerrigan asked.
It revealed Beryl Spencer. It was also a form of misdirection, I believe, in case Freean was ever captured. It would survive in its seeming irrelevance, and the false message would be of unequal importance because the information was old. Unfortunately, it did not help Freean in the end.
Captain Mapstone gazed at the horn in her lap.
We cannot dwell on what might have been. Don't blame yourself, Kerrigan, about not getting the real message to us sooner. You were right before. You are not a Green Rider. At least, not a trained Green Rider, and I was at fault to assume you would know how things worked. If it helps, let me say that you, more than anyone else, helped save the king today.
Thank you, Kerrigan whispered.
I'm not sure you are the one who should be doing the thanking. The captain's hand slipped unconsciously to the bandage that bound her head wound.
We owe you much. Even the dead do.
She held out her other hand, and it gleamed with gold. Gold-winged horse brooches. Kerrigan was astonished.
You took them? You took them from the dead?
Yes. Like Joy's brooch you brought back to us, they always find their way home. These brooches are curious things, more curious than you know. New riders will be called to the service, and they will wear these same brooches. With the brooches, they will discover new talents and use them. When they retire from the service or die, the brooch will call out to someone new. It has always been this way.
But I wasn't called, Kerrigan said.
Are you so sure? The captain smiled. The calling to become a rider comes in a variety of ways. Perhaps you are right about it being the situation. Freean's dying, you being right there. She shrugged. Their qualities are peculiar. They seem to attract strange adventures and extraordinary people to the wearer. Some believe it is just the nature of the job, of being a king's messenger. Yet others believe it is the magic. Kerrigan touched her brooch. It felt like cold metal, that was all. Yet she knew what it was capable of.
What do you believe?
What do I believe? I believe in all kinds of possibilities. But as far as the brooches go, it is the rare moment that life has been dull for me since I first pinned one on some 20 years ago. The captain unfolded her legs, and in what looked like an agonizing movement that shone clearly in her taut features, she stood up. She covered the pain with another smile, but Kerrigan could see it in her eyes. Come, Captain Mapstone said, and we will find out what happens next. Kerrigan raised herself from the sweet grasses and followed in the tracks of the captain, who limped on ahead.
You, more than anyone, helped save the king today, the captain had said.
Kerrigan had tossed a bunchberry petal to the breeze. It was supposed to bring a friend in need. And though she had thought so at the time, the arrival of the Green Riders had not been the result of the bunchberry petal. Did the bunchberry petals lose their efficacy after a certain amount of time? She no sooner asked herself the question when something small and white, like a snowflake, drifted out of the sky. She held her hand out, and the bunchberry petal settled on her palm.
How do I interpret this? Am I my own friend in need? I can depend on myself?
She blew it off her palm, smiling for the first time in hours. She could depend on herself, yet hadn't she been surrounded by friends the entire time? Friends who had helped her along in her journey, or who tried to protect her. Where would she be without them? She paused and called out to the captain.
I'll join you in a moment.
Captain Mapstone nodded, and Kerrigan walked over to where the wounded rested.
Among them, huddled in a coarse blanket, slept Alton Dyer. In the dusk, his expression was one of peace, without a hint of the day's strivings. No sign of pain or worry, simply the release of sleep, and with it, a certain innocence. Kerrigan shuddered to think of what Black Arrows might have done to this young man. She had seen it all too vividly, too many times. First, Free in Coble Bay, then Joy Overway, and those who died today. It was not simply death, but a twisted, dark, and tortured path. What made Alton different from the others was that she had grown to know him, while the others had been strangers. With Alton, she could put a face with a name, a face that was alive with laughter and dreams and the future. She knelt beside him, and when he shifted in his sleep, she adjusted the blanket about his shoulders. Today, he had stood between her and Black Arrows. Her fingers brushed his cheek, and she felt the warmth of him.
"Thank you, Alton," she whispered. "I only hope I'm worthy of what you did for me today. You are a true friend."
And perhaps more than a friend, but confusion fluttered in her heart at the thought. She made sure he rested as comfortably as possible on the ground where he slept, the regular rise and fall of his chest reassuring. She left him reluctantly and joined the able-bodied survivors of the ambush, who sat in a circle in the waning sun. Among them were Horse Marshal Martell, a couple of his officers, and Beryl Spencer. It was as if the king and his followers had become primitive hunters, back to the dark days before Sacaridia was what it had become, when folk sat in council on the rough ground and told the news of the lands in stories by a fire.
"I've posted sentries should any of the enemy decide to return."
Horse Marshal Martell sat very erect in his short coat of deep navy, a red sash knotted at his waist. Silver buttons and a gorget about his neck gleamed in the dwindling light. His gold marshal's shoulder cords and the red-plumed helmet, placed carefully in the grass beside him, made him an impeccably well-turned-out officer, though he had discarded his breastplate earlier. Even the formal uniform of the Green Riders did not compare to his field uniform.
"We should make camp for the night."
"It sounds sensible," King Zachary said. "It would be preferable not to move the wounded tonight, at least not far. And I think most of us are deeply tired. However, I am concerned about what my brother is up to."
"You should be, Excellency," Beryl Spencer said. "He planned to march on your castle with more than twice what you have garrisoned there."
Martell glanced at Captain Mapstone.
"Do you trust her word? Is she not the one who tried to kill you?"
The captain nodded tiredly. "She speaks the truth. The compulsion placed on her by the Elysian is mostly gone, as far as I can tell. There is still a residue of the spell, but I believe it is fading. Besides, the message brought to us by Kerrigan confirms Hamilton's intent." Kerrigan squirmed as the horse marshal's light gray eyes fell on her.
"Then we ride," he said.
"Just like that?" the captain asked. "You won't know anything about the prince's force or its position." Martell stuck his chin out resolutely. It was covered by a dense but closely cropped flaxen beard.
"My soldiers are well trained in reconnaissance, not to mention fighting, if it comes to—"
"With all due respect, Marshal," Beryl broke in, "your soldiers almost panicked at the sight of this battle's aftermath. You expect them to face 500 of the enemy."
"Beryl,"
Captain Mapstone said in warning. Martell's eyes flashed in anger.
"I will not have this rider insult—"
King Zachary raised his hand to stop them.
"Hold, my friends, hold. Captain Mapstone is right. We cannot rush in without knowing what we are up against. And the horse marshal is right, too. His riders are trained for reconnaissance."
"Do we know something of what we're up against, then?"
asked one of the horse marshal's officers.
"Major," said King Zachary.
Beryl inclined her head to the king. "Before we left Merwilton, the governor and I—" She hastened a quick glance at the old man who sat some distance away with Drang under the watchful eyes of cavalry guards. "The governor mustered Merwellian regulars and hired some merc companies to follow the prince to take the castle."
"Even with thousands of soldiers," King Zachary said, He would be hard-pressed to take the castle. It is well fortified.
And the castle has been warned, Captain Mapstone added. He was prepared for a siege, my lord, and do not forget he knows the castle almost as well as you. And there is one other thing. Beryl looked about the group with haunted eyes. You, my lord, were not the only one to have someone inside the enemy's court.
What? Zachary cried.
Crow, Captain Mapstone snarled. It must be him.
The Castellan?
Martell's expression was incredulous. Yes, Beryl said. On two occasions I tried to warn you. Once, when Ryder Mepharthen delivered the ball and banquet invitation to Lord Merwell, and a second time when I tried to speak to Kerrigan after the ball. Both times, I was thwarted. Kerrigan tensed as Beryl glanced at her, but the rider's expression was not accusatory.
I left Crow in charge, Zachary muttered. It is because of him we arrived so late, Martell said. He kept delaying me.
To Kerrigan, a shadow seemed to drop over the king. Another betrayal. First his brother, then one of his liege lords. Now one of his most trusted advisers. In his eyes, she could see him asking himself why, but he would never voice it. He could not, at least not now. For he was king, and his duty was to lead fearlessly. In an odd way, his hurt pleased her, for it made him human and not simply a king with a hard visage who ruled without compassion. She hoped the intrigue and betrayals would never make him indifferent and callous to his people.
I can send a small detachment for reconnaissance, Martell was saying. They would not be detected in the dark. Once we know what your brother has achieved, we can plan our next move.
The king sighed.
If he has taken the castle, it means exile for me, until I can muster a force large enough to retake it. I will be with you, my lord,
Martell said, with his fist to his heart. The others in the circle added their resounding agreement. King Zachary was visibly touched.
Then there is nothing more for today, except to get some recon.
A shout went up from among some of Martell's soldiers on the perimeter.
Ryder coming!
Hands fell to swords and the group ringed themselves around the king.
It's a green rider!
All relaxed a bit with this news, but did not let down their guard. Soon the approach of hoofbeats was clearly heard, and a rider galloped at full speed into the valley. He hauled on the reins of his gray steed, dismounting simultaneously. He was a silhouette in the dusk as he approached with long strides. King Zachary's remaining weapon, Rory, put himself between the messenger and the king. It's all right, Captain Mapstone said quietly. I know him. It's Connolly. The young man's dark hair was plastered to his forehead with sweat. He had run his horse hard to reach them, and without slowing his stride, he came before the king and dropped to one knee.
Sire, he said. Do you bear news, messenger? Yes, my lord.
He stood up then and looked around at each of them. When his dark eyes rested on Kerrigan, they registered surprise. Just as quickly, his gaze shifted back to the king.
My lord, the castle has been taken.
The king seemed to sink into himself. Exclamations of dismay passed among the others. But I warned Captain Abel, Captain Mapstone said.
Treachery was at work then.
Connolly placed his hand on her sleeve.
I'm sorry, but he and some others hang at the castle gates. He was a good man, Martell said.
The others stood silently in disbelief in the midst of chorusing peepers. Finally, Captain Mapstone shook her head. He was a good man, and a good friend. We've lost so many good friends.
Yet, I'm grateful, Connolly said, to have found my captain and my king alive. I suspect our enemies believe you were defeated here, but when they hear nothing of victory by sunrise, they may grow suspicious and send someone to look things over. It is not safe to stay. We can withdraw to another place, Martell said.
The king waved the idea off.
We will do that. But first, I want to hear what Ryder Connolly knows of the takeover. Actually, very little, Excellency, except No one in the city is panicked.
The king smiled grimly.
Another day, another king. Just so long as it does not interfere with their lives. I was spending some time at an inn I frequent on Chanty Street,
Conley explained.
After a vigorous run, Osric, another rider, was filling me in on the strange happenings over the past couple of weeks. We heard the hoofbeats of Prince Hamilton's army riding in, followed by siege engines and infantry. They simply marched through the city gates. No one was there to close them or defend them. The city went on about its business, people moving aside as the prince rode in. Some along the streets even cheered and hailed him.
Zachary winced.
Yes, my brother has always had his supporters.
Very true, sire, though there was a show of force at the castle gates. Osric and I followed the army, watching and trying to keep out of sight, of course.
How did they get in?
They scaled the scaffolding set up for repair on the castle wall, my lord,
Conley said.
They climbed over the wall and took Captain Abel and killed many others. The guard seemed to lose its spirit then.
Zachary shook his head.
The scaffolding. Crow told me the wall needed repair. Beyond that, Connolly said, I don't know what transpired behind the castle gates, except the gates were opened, and the prince rode right through.
How did you know where to find us? The king asked.
Osric had heard of the king's annual hunt, where it was headed, and of a bunch running off after you. I fled the city before anyone noticed me, hoping to find you alive and well. Osric is still in the city, trying to locate other riders and regular militia who are still loyal.
Well done, Conley, Captain Mapstone said. She turned to King Zachary and placed a hand on his shoulder. You cannot blame yourself for this. This is your brother's doing.
There was a time when I would have gladly given him the throne.
I know, but you gave up your personal freedom to lead Sacaridia, so your brother would not destroy it.
He may still.
The evening darkened a shade deeper, and the chorus of peepers quickened like a heartbeat. Is there anything else, Conley? Beryl asked.
Yes.
He settled his gaze on Kerrigan, and a tremor of fear ran up her spine.
Your father came seeking you.
What? Kerrigan stood ramrod straight.
This was our second meeting, as Captain Mapstone can attest. He thought the captain or I would have information about your whereabouts. He must have seen me on the street and followed me to the inn. This was before Prince Hamilton and his army came through. Of course, I had heard of your remarkable journey and arrival, but little more than that. He was surprised and more than a little gratified to hear you were even alive. He questioned me as to where he could find you. Last I heard, you were still at the castle. I sent him there to find you.
It took a moment for what he had said to sink in. You sent my father to the castle before Prince Hamilton arrived? Conley looked at his feet.
I'm sorry. I assume he got caught up in events, but I didn't know what was about to happen.
Kerrigan thought she was going to explode with anger and frustration, but she just turned away with clenched hands, missing the king's look of sympathy.
We must think about our next move,
Martell said. I think I have an idea, Beryl Spencer said. But it means we are going to have to move fast, and it means we need someone to go inside the castle gates to look the situation over. I'll do it. Everyone looked at Kerrigan in astonishment, and she stepped right up to Beryl, her expression one of sheer determination.
Kerrigan,
the king started. I said I will do it. I'll get into the castle. Beryl started to protest, but Captain Mapstone motioned her to silence. Yes, Kerrigan will do it. Woman of the Shadows. The shadows absorbed Kerrigan. She darted from the dark side of one building to another. She was like a phantom, fading in and out, and if anyone marked her passage through the streets of Sacker City, they might discount it later as some vision or a trick of their eyes. Kerrigan used her brooch to the full extent of its powers, using it to conceal herself from the armed militia of Prince Hamilton Hillander. Some roamed the open streets, others stood on the city walls, But the city was not closed, nor the populace molested. Yet. A wise move on Hamilton's part. The more he left folk to their ordinary lives, the quicker they would accept him as their new king, and the less chance he would face a rebellion. A few folk still meandered on the streets. Peddlers closed up their handcarts and pushed them away for the night. Others entered inns and pubs. A good portion of the populace was in for the night, and they did not notice if there was a green flicker where the gold light of their lamps spilled out into the dark. From time to time, Kerrigan rested, sinking to the ground in a darkened close or alley, struggling to catch her breath and relieve herself of the suffocating gray world she submerged herself into every time she used the power of the brooch to fade out. Now she squatted in the narrow close between a chapel of the moon and a market, among the stinking refuse that hadn't sold in the latter. Both buildings were dark and empty, and she felt safe enough that she could drop the invisibility for a few moments. She mopped sweat from her brow with her sleeve. The headache was coming back, and exhaustion made her body tremble. Would the day never end, or had it become an eternal nightmare? Black clouds drifted across the nearly halved moon, and she darted into the street again, fading out and avoiding the light pooling about the oil-burning street lamps. As she trotted along, King Zachary's short hunting sword slapped her thigh, a constant reminder of him. He had protested her further involvement with his brother's takeover, but Captain Mapstone convinced him Kerrigan was the only one to complete this mission. When Kerrigan demonstrated the power of her brooch, he could not argue. "I must go," Kerrigan had said. "If my father is there, he may be in danger." King Zachary smiled. It was a smile saddened by too many things.
"I hope he knows how fortunate he is to have a daughter like you."
"I am fortunate to have him as my father."
Zachary lifted his sword and baldric over his head, and awkwardly, with one hand, placed it over her shoulder.
"You want me to take your sword?"
Kerrigan asked incredulously.
"Alas, brave lady, it is but a hunting sword. Yet it will be better than nothing, for I see you are without your own."
He had put his hand on her shoulder, and she could see many things in his brown eyes, things she did not wish to think about.
"Come back," he began,
and she thought he might have finished with, "to me," but he turned hurriedly away without saying another word. Kerrigan wrapped her hand around the hilt of the sword now. It was a fancy thing, with an intricate guard and blade etched with a hunting scene. Hopefully, she would not have to use it. A hunting sword it was, but she did not pursue sport. Before she knew it, her tired feet brought her within the shadows of the castle gates. A curious sight greeted her there. The Anti-Monarchy Society gathered together, as if making some sort of plan. She moved closer and heard the confident tones of Lorelei Doran, who stood in the middle of the group.
"We can't deny something big has happened," Lorelei said. "But even if Zachary is dead, and his brother now rules, it shouldn't change our plans. After all, monarchy in all forms is tyranny, and this monarch seems more tyrannical than some."
Her supporters glanced toward the gates. The gates were wide open, but well guarded by soldiers in Merwellian scarlet. Others stood watch in silhouette on the surrounding wall, archers among them. Torches illuminated corpses swaying from nooses on either side of the gates. Kerrigan would have to move fast, lest the torches break the spell of fading and arouse the Merwellians to her presence. A pair of sentries marched back and forth beyond the gates, and she would have to time it just right. The Anti-Monarchy Society broke its huddled grouping and defiantly faced the gates. As one voice they chanted, "Monarchy is tyranny! No king is a good king! Monarchy is tyranny!" The sentries beyond the gate passed one another, and Kerrigan sprinted across the drawbridge. She nearly ran into a hulking soldier who appeared out of nowhere in the gray mist of her vision. She veered just in time to miss him. She bolted over to the guardhouse and leaned against the cold stone wall. Boots swung above her head. Ropes creaked on timbers. The sound knotted her stomach. The Hanged hovered above her like stiff marionettes some puppeteer had abandoned, the flickering of torches distorting their bloodless wooden features. The guard Kerrigan had nearly run into had simply stepped out onto the drawbridge to get a better look at the Anti-Monarchy Society. Miraculously, he seemed unaware of her. She felt her way around the guardhouse and watched the sentries pace back and forth beyond the gates once more. Instead of running straight across the courtyard, she continued to edge along the guardhouse, hurrying past the open doorway where lamplight glowed, and under the portcullis. Once she was inside the gate, she adhered to the shadows of the inner castle wall. One of the sentries paused his rhythmic pacing. The other joined him.
"Something wrong?" "No, just... I thought I saw something by the guardhouse caught in the light."
His companion glanced in Kerrigan's general direction.
"Nothing there. Torchlight can trick your eyes." "I suppose. What with those corpses hanging about?"
Kerrigan listened no further and sprinted across the courtyard. There was a breezeway here that separated the outer courtyard from the ornamental gardens of the inner courtyard and connected two wings of the castle. A glance at the main entrance to the castle convinced her she would gain no entry there, for it was heavily guarded by Merwellians. She swung her legs over the low wall and into the breezeway. Surely some guards would patrol this way. No sooner had the thought entered her mind than guards appeared from either end of the breezeway bearing torches. They paced toward one another. Kerrigan dived over the low wall on the other side of the breezeway and fell to the ground of the inner courtyard, right into a clump of rose bushes. She yelped involuntarily and bit her lower lip before more could spill out of her mouth. The sickeningly sweet fragrance of crushed roses thickened in the air about her. A torch-bearing guard paused near her on the breezeway and waited for the other to join him.
"You hear something?"
he asked.
"Nope,"
the other said affably.
"Quiet as the dead. Only interesting place is the throne room."
The first guard snorted.
"I would like to show some of those nobles a thing or two myself,"
he sniffed.
"Phew, just smell those roses."
The two moved off, conversing companionably, and Kerrigan breathed again. She plucked thorns out of her hands, arms, and legs, and stood up. "I'm doing well," she muttered to herself with sarcasm, as she unsnagged her coat from one of the bushes. "Vicious shrubs." She trotted along the garden paths to where she remembered the ballroom was. Perhaps she could enter there, undetected. But when she reached the ballroom entrance, it was ablaze with light. Inside, soldiers in silver and black were jammed together under many watchful guards in scarlet. She turned away, but the sound of a commotion just outside the doorway caught her attention. A guard pulled on the arm of a small, struggling prisoner.
"Come on, little greenie. Taggart wants a little fun."
"No!"
"Mel?" Kerrigan cursed silently. As a member of the Greenfoot, Mel would be treated just like any of the other soldiers, or even worse. The guard slapped the writhing girl and knocked her to the ground. Mel cried out again in a terrible sob. Kerrigan knew the feeling. The helplessness of being under the power of someone much bigger and stronger than she. She could almost smell the foul Garoti and feel his hard, calloused hands on her. Without another thought, King Zachary's sword was in her grasp. Although it might ruin everything, she could not simply let the soldier hurt her friend. She knew the fear. She crept up silently behind them, and though the light from the ballroom touched her, she was barely perceptible. The soldier was too busy with his prey anyway, and would not have noticed Kerrigan even if she were fully visible. He giggled like a boy. Kerrigan plunged the sword into his back. There was no sound, no outcry from the soldier. He simply collapsed on top of Mel. Her cries were muffled beneath him. Kerrigan hoisted the man away, and Mel curled up into a ball in a fit of sobbing.
"Mel,"
Kerrigan whispered. She reached down and touched the girl. Mel cried louder and kicked out.
"Mel, it's me, Kerrigan."
Mel rubbed her eyes.
"Kerrigan?"
Her tone was one of disbelief.
"Where?"
Kerrigan touched her brooch. The gray world fell away, and she sighed with weariness. No sooner had she appeared than Mel sprang over to her and wrapped her arms around her. The girl wept into her coat, her whole body racked hard by sobs like unrelieved grief.
"Quietly now," Kerrigan said in a soothing whisper.
She stroked Mel's hair and rubbed her back, keeping watch on the ballroom door, fearing they would be discovered at any moment.
It was so terrible.
Mel's whole body shuddered.
"You're fine now," Kerrigan said, still stroking. "You're fine."
Then Mel pushed away, sniffing, her face wet with tears.
It's really you."
"Who did you think?" Kerrigan smiled down at her.
I thought he went away, or were dead."
Mel wrapped her arms around her again, and a new freshet of tears began.
"The captain's dead, isn't she? And King Zachary?"
"Absolutely not." Mel stopped in mid-sob.
"What?"
"They are both alive. We had some trouble, but we made it."
"Truly?"
Kerrigan nodded, and Mel wiped tears off her cheeks, a wide grin shining on her face.
"Thank you, Kerrigan. You don't know how happy I am."
"I can guess," Kerrigan said. "We can't stay here. Those guards are going to miss this fellow soon." She pointed at the dead soldier. "Help me pull him into the bushes." They each took an arm and dragged until he was concealed in the darkest shadows they could find, beneath a clump of shrubbery. "He didn't hurt you, did he?" Kerrigan asked. Mel shook her head, then shivered a little.
He frightened me."
"I know," Kerrigan said. "Listen to me. You have got to get out of here. Is there somewhere you can hide?" Mel thought for a moment.
"Maybe at the stable."
"Good. You hide as well as you can, all right? There are some things I've got to take care of here, and it may be a while. Don't be scared, but don't come out of hiding. Do you understand?" Mel nodded.
"Good."
Kerrigan looked down at her friend, but her face blurred. She rocked on her feet, assailed by dizziness. She passed her hands over her eyes.
"You all right?"
Mel asked.
"You look, I don't know, not good."
Kerrigan shrugged. "I'm fine. I've just been using my brooch an awful lot. Now you run. I've got some things to do." Mel started away, but glanced over her shoulder at Kerrigan.
"Go,"
Kerrigan said, waving her off. Mel disappeared across the courtyard, and Kerrigan prayed she would reach safety unmolested. She sagged in the shadows herself, closing her eyes briefly and taking a breath. She just wanted a nice long sleep in a feather bed. But just as she thought she was at the end of her endurance, she pushed herself to continue. She wandered the inner courtyard looking for an entrance into the castle. She did not use her brooch as long as no one was about to detect her. Every time she faded out, her headache intensified, and the brooch sapped her energy. She came to some great glass doors, an unusual contrast to the massive stone walls of the castle. In fact, there were many windows here that glimmered like black ice in the moonlight. Whatever the room beyond, it was dark, and no guards were nearby. She tried the latch, and it yielded easily to her touch. She took one last look behind her and stepped inside. She wished she had her moonstone now to reveal the room and aid her in navigating its vague expanse. But the moonstone was gone forever. Just so much crushed crystal. The room, she decided, was some sort of sunroom or study. She could make out the shapes of bookshelves and the edges of heavy furniture. She wondered if this was a place King Zachary spent much time in. She moved across the room with care, but still jammed her thigh on the edge of a table. She barely managed to suppress a cry of pain. "I'll be black and blue from head to toe," she mumbled, rubbing her throbbing thigh. She aimed for a bar of light that filtered beneath the door, and managed quite well without bumping into too many objects or knocking anything over. Once she reached the door, she dropped to her knees and peered through the space where the light came through. And she listened. She could not see or hear a soul. Just in case someone was out there, she touched her brooch and faded out, then cracked the door open. The corridor outside was only dimly lit, and it was empty, save for some old suits of armor standing at age-old attention. She slipped out of the room, and using her own best judgment, headed in the direction she believed the throne room lay. The Ghost. Stevik Glavian was not sure he could take much more of the screaming. A few nobles had dared to defy Prince, no, he corrected himself, King Hamilton. One noble lay dead with blood flowing out of his nose, ears, and mouth. A few others had given in to the strange power Hamilton wielded before they met the same fate. Hamilton would put his hands on their shoulders or heads. Bolts of black energy would spark and crackle around his hands, and the victim would cry out in pain.
I pledge my undying loyalty,
the most recent unfortunate said. It was a plump man on his knees with head bowed. Blood oozed from his nose. The fire seemed to burn within and without Hamilton. His loyal servants, the nobles who had capitulated, stood behind him in the throne room. The strange stone that hung at his throat glimmered, and at times seemed to pulsate like a living thing. Stevik and Savano had found an alcove with a bench beneath one of the tall windows that marched down the length of the throne room. The bench was carved of stone and was cold and uncomfortable, but it was better than standing among the sweating, shaking nobles. Hamilton had dismissed him and Savano as unimportant when he discovered they were lowly merchants, yet they were not permitted to leave. The old woman, Devon Wainwright, stood among the nobles. Stevik remembered her back to the time he had visited Queen Eisen to petition for recognition of his clan. Devon had been advisor even then, and as stern as a weapon, but fair and careful in her judgments. She had aged a great deal in the time intervening, but her mind still seemed sharp. She talked quietly with a rather beautiful, statuesque woman with golden hair hanging long and loose to her waist. She wore black, a stark, mournful contrast to her features, as if a grieving widow. Soon Hamilton would question their loyalties. Stevik hoped both would acquiesce without a fuss. His seat was shrouded in shadow and partially obscured by a thick pillar. If he remembered correctly from his previous visit, weapons had stood guard in these alcoves. They were dark, he supposed, on purpose. He wondered what had become of King Zachary's weapons. He wondered what had become of the king himself. Likely, the king and all his weapons are dead. Fleeting thoughts, like what Hamilton's reign would do to commerce and relations with other countries, streamed through his mind. But most of all, he wondered and worried about Kerrigan. He had been so close to finding her. The rider Conley had told him some strange story of how Kerrigan came to Sacker City bearing a message for the king. Stevik was not clear on what Kerrigan was doing with the Green Rider message in the first place. Conley was vague on the details, for he had only just heard the story himself, but he seemed to think Kerrigan had survived many frightening adventures.
"Tavano," Stevik said, "do you believe those stories that Ryder told us about Kerrigan?"
The old man grunted.
"I believe he thought them true, and why not?"
Stevik shrugged.
"My own daughter, a schoolgirl, facing brigands on the road? A resourceful schoolgirl. We taught her to be so."
Stevik rubbed his upper lip thoughtfully. Conley had directed them to the castle, where they sought out Captain Mapstone, but there was not a single Green Rider to be found. As they walked the castle grounds, they were nearly run down by the cavalry. They waited some time at Rider Barracks for someone to appear, but no one did. Then they resolved to speak with the king himself. But when they stepped outside, soldiers in silver and black were running wildly in all directions. Arrows whined over the castle wall, and everyone was shouting. When an arrow took out a soldier right in their path, they retreated to the barracks to await the outcome. It was not long before soldiers wearing Merwellian scarlet found them. They were mistaken for a noble and his guard, and were taken to the throne room to be dealt with by Prince Hamilton. and there they had been ever since. Still, one question remained unanswered. Where was Kerrigan? Had she made it off the castle grounds before the fighting broke out? Stevic stretched his long legs before him and leaned back against the stone wall. Castellan Crow's voice lilted as he made the pronouncement.
And Lepetri province joins His Majesty's grand purpose.
There goes commerce,
Savano muttered.
Our dear Lord Governor is not the one to go against the current, Stevic said.
He allowed the shadows to hang about him. Hamilton and Crow were but distant things in a glittering light that did not include him. He gave up being surprised by Hamilton's use of magic and by the treachery of Zachary's Castellan, one of his most important advisors. He tried to ignore the scene of two guards in scarlet dragging away another body. In the darkness, he imagined he saw a figure in green weaving in and out among the columns of the opposite wall. She was wraith-like and thin and hard-looking. He could not see her clearly. She seemed to fade in and out of the light. She carried herself like one who is hunted and keenly aware of all that is about her. She was self-possessed and unafraid. She turned to him and looked directly at him. Her features were filmy and blurred, but he felt her eyes on him, haunted eyes that had seen too much. Eyes he recognized. He sat up straight, and his mouth fell open. She drew her finger to her lips, then melted away into a shadow, became part of it, and did not reemerge. Stevic's heart plunged.
No,
he moaned. Savano looked at him, startled.
What's wrong?
He whispered.
Kerrigan. What about her?
She's dead.
She's dead.
Stevic put his face in his hands.
What?
Her ghost.
Stevic pointed a shaking finger where he had last seen her.
Her ghost? Now look here. That Conley lad said she was alive.
Was. She's dead now. I saw her ghost.
Stevic shook his head and put his ashen face in his trembling hands. Jendara peered in each alcove along the east wall in search of the merchant. There had been something unsettlingly familiar about him, and she now took the opportunity to seek him out while King Hamilton was preoccupied with terrorizing his nobles. She found the man and his guard tucked away in one of the alcoves, and to her surprise, he was weeping, the cargo master's hand on his shoulder.
"You there,"
she said to the cargo master. Her voice was nasal and muffled from having her nose broken.
"What is the problem?"
The cargo master looked at her with jaundiced eyes.
"It is none of your never mind," he said.
"I could cut your heart out before you drew your next breath, old man."
Jindara unsheathed her sword and watched as comprehension dawned on the man's face when he saw the black band on her blade. The cargo master looked up at her, but the disgust in his expression had only deepened.
"What in life made you fall to such a level, sword master?"
Jindara smiled, showing her canines.
"You say I have fallen? Am I not the personal weapon to the King of Saccharidia? It seems I have ascended to a higher place."
"That is no king."
The cargo master pointed in the direction of the throne. Swiftly, the blade tip pressed against the old man's throat. She watched his Adam's apple bob as he swallowed.
"Do you wish to die?"
she asked him.
"I have no such wish,"
he said with equal intensity.
"But I see it in your eyes."
Jindara laughed.
"We become weapons because we expect death." "Then I will rephrase my question. What has made you such a bitter woman?"
"A man," she said. She pushed the cargo master away with the flat of her blade. She gazed down on the overcome merchant.
"Tell me what ails him, old man."
"Grief."
"Is that all? There is enough to go around these days."
"His daughter has been missing. Now he believes her to be dead."
"He believes? Doesn't he know?"
"He says he saw her ghost."
What? Just now?
Aye.
There was a prickling on the back of Jindara's neck. She placed the tip of her sword beneath the grieving man's chin.